Chapter 4. Cooled by the shade of the cedar, refreshed by the contents of the amber glass in which ice tinkled so musically when he lifted it to his lips, the Honourable Galahad, at the moment of Lord Emsworth's arrival, had achieved a nirvana-like repose. Storms might be raging elsewhere in the grounds of Blandings Castle, but there on the lawn there was peace, the perfect, unruffled peace which in this world seems to come only to those who have done nothing whatever to deserve it. The Honourable Galahad Threepwood, in his 57th year, was a dapper little gentleman, on whose grey but still thickly covered head the weight of a consistently misspent life rested lightly. His flannel suit sat jauntily upon his wiry frame, a black-rimmed monocle gleamed jauntily in his eye. Everything about this musketeer of the 90s was jaunty. It was a standing mystery to all who knew him that one who had had such an extraordinarily good time all his life should, in the evening of that life, be so superbly robust. Wan contemporaries, who had once painted a gaslit London red in his company, and were now doomed to an existence of dry toast, Vichy water, and the German cure resorts, felt very strongly on this point. A man of his antecedents, they considered, ought by rights to be rounding off his career in a bath chair instead of flitting about the place, still chaffing head waiters as of old and calling for the wine list without a tremor. A little cock sparrow of a man, one of the old guard which dies but does not surrender. Sitting there under the cedar, he looked as if he were just making ready to go to some dance hall of the days when dance halls were dance halls, from which in the quiet dawn it would take at least three waiters, two commissionaires, and a policeman to eject him. In a world so full of beautiful things, where he felt we should all be as happy as kings, the spectacle of his agitated brother shocked the Honourable Galahad.
"Good God, Clarence, you look like a bereaved tapeworm. What's the matter?"
Lord Emsworth fluttered for a moment, speechless. Then he found words.
"Galahad, the worst has happened.
Eh?
Parslow has struck."
"Struck? You mean he's been biffing you?"
No. I mean it has happened just as you warned me. He has been too clever for us. He's got round Connie and persuaded her to engage his nephew as my new secretary."
The Honourable Galahad removed his monocle and began to polish it thoughtfully. He could understand his companion's concern now.
"She told me so only a moment ago. You see what this means. He's determined to work a mischief on the Empress, and now he has contrived to insinuate an accomplice into the very heart of the home. I see it all,"
said Lord Emsworth, his voice soaring to the upper register.
"He failed with Baxter, and now he is trying again with this young Bodkin."
"Bodkin? Young Monty Bodkin?"
"Yes. What are we to do, Galahad?" said Lord Emsworth.
He trembled. It would have pained the immaculate Monty, could he have known that this prospective employer was picturing him at this moment as a furtive, shifty-eyed, rat-like person of the gangster type, liable at the first opportunity to sneak into the styes of innocent pigs and plant pineapple bombs in their bran mash. The Honourable Galahad replaced his monocle.
"Monty Bodkin,"
he said, refreshing himself with a sip from his glass.
"I remember him well. Nice boy. Not at all the sort of fellow who would nobble pigs. Wait a minute, Clarence. This wants thinking over."
He mused a while.
"No," he said, "you can dismiss young Bodkin as a hostile force altogether."
"What?"
"Put him right out of your mind," insisted the Honourable Galahad. "Parslow isn't planning to strike through him at all."
"But Galahad, no, take it from me. Can't you see for yourself that the thing's much too obvious, much too straightforward, not young Parslow's proper form at all? Reason it out. He must know that we would suspect a nephew of his. Then why is it worth his while to get him into the place? Shall I tell you, Clarence?"
"Do,"
said Lord Emsworth feebly, gaping like a fish. As the head of the family was standing up and he was sitting down, it was impossible for the Honourable Galahad to tap him meaningly on the shoulder. He prodded him meaningly in the leg.
"Because," he said, "he wants us to suspect him."
"Wants us to suspect him?"
"Wants us to,"
said the Honourable Galahad.
He hopes by introducing Monte Bodkin into the place to get us watching him, following his every movement, keeping our eyes glued onto him, so that when the real accomplice acts, we shall be looking in the wrong direction. God bless my soul, said Lord Emsworth, appalled. Oh, it's all right, said the Honourable Galahad, soothingly. A cunning scheme. We're too smart to fall for it. We see through it and are prepared. He gave Lord Emsworth's leg another significant prod. Shall I tell you what's going to happen, Clarence?
Do,
said Lord Emsworth. I can read Parslow's mind like a book. A day or two after young Monty's arrival, there'll be a mysterious stranger sneaking about the grounds in the vicinity of the Empress's tie. He will be there because Parslow, taking it for granted that our attention will be riveted on young Monty, would imagine that the coast is clear. God bless my soul. And apparently the coast will be clear. We must arrange that. From now on, Clarence, you must not loaf about the Empress openly. You must conceal yourself in the background, and you must instruct Pertbright to conceal himself in the background. This fella must be led to suppose that vigilance has been relaxed. By these means, we shall catch him red-handed. In Lord Emsworth's eye, as he gazed at his brother, there was the reverential look of a disciple at the feet of his master. He'd always known, he told himself, that as a practical adviser in matters having to do with the seamier side of life, the other was unsurpassed. It was the result, he supposed, of the environment in which he had spent his formative years. Membership of the Old Pelican Club might not elevate a man socially, but there was no doubt about its educative properties. If it dulled the moral sense, it undoubtedly sharpened the intellect. "You've taken a great weight off my mind, Galahad," he said. "I feel sure you're perfectly right. The only mistake I think you make is in supposing that this young Bodkin is harmless. I'm convinced that he will require watching." "Well, watch him, then, if it'll make you any happier." "It will," said Lord Emsworth decidedly. "And meanwhile, I will be giving Pertbright his instructions. Tell him to lurk." "Exactly. Some rude disguise, such as a tree or a pail of potato peel, would help." Lord Emsworth reflected. "I don't think Pertbright could disguise himself as a tree." "Nonsense. What do you pay him for?" Lord Emsworth continued dubious. Only God, he seemed to be feeling, can make a tree. "Well, at any rate, tell him to lurk." "Oh, he shall certainly lurk." "From now on," began the Honourable Galahad, and broke off to wave at some object in his companion's rear. The latter turned. "Ah, that nice little Smith girl," he said. Sue had appeared on the edge of the lawn. Lord Emsworth beamed vaguely in her direction. "By the way, Galahad," he said, "is a chorus girl the same as a ballet girl?"
"Certainly not. Different thing altogether."
"I thought so," said Lord Emsworth. "Connie's an ass."
He pottered away, and Sue crossed the turf to where the Honourable Galahad sat. The author of the reminiscences scanned her affectionately through his monocle. Amazing, he was thinking, how like her mother she was. He noticed it more every day. Dolly's walk, and just that way of tilting her chin and smiling at you that Dolly had had. For an instant, the years fell away from the Honourable Galahad Threepwood, and something that was not of this world went whispering through the garden. Sue stood looking down at him. She placed a maternal finger on top of his head and began to twist the grey hair round it.
"Well, young Galley?
Well, young Sue?
You look very comfortable."
"I am comfortable."
"You won't be long. The luncheon gong will be going in a minute."
The Honourable Galahad sighed. There was always something, he reflected.
"What a curse meals are. Don't let's go in."
"I'm going in all right, my good child. I'm starving."
"Pure imagination. Do you mean to say you're not hungry, Galley?"
"Of course I'm not. No healthy person really needs food. If people would only stick to drinking, doctors would go out of business. I can state you a case that proves it. Old Freddy Potts in the year 98.
Old Freddy Potts in the year 98, did you say, Mr. Bones? Old Freddy Potts in the year 98, repeated the Honourable Galahad firmly. He lived almost entirely on Scotch whisky, and in the year 98, this prudent habit saved him from an exceedingly unpleasant attack of hedgehog poisoning.
What poisoning?
Hedgehog poisoning. It was down in the south of France that it happened. Freddy had gone to stay with his brother Eustace at his villa at Grasse. Practically a teetotaler, this brother, and in consequence, passionately addicted to food. Still, I can't see why he wanted to eat hedgehogs. He did not want to eat hedgehogs. Nothing was further from his intention. But on the second day of old Freddy's visit, he gave his chef 20 francs to go to market and buy a chicken for dinner. And the chef, wandering along, happened to see a dead hedgehog lying in the road. It had been there some days, as a matter of fact, but this was the first time he'd noticed it. So, feeling that here was where he pouched 20 francs. I wish you wouldn't tell me stories like this just before lunch. If it puts you off your food, so much the better. Bring the roses to your cheeks. Well, as I was saying, the chef, who was a thrifty sort of chap and knew that he could make a dainty dinner dish out of his old grandmother, if allowed to mess about with a few sauces, added the 20 francs to his savings and gave Freddy and Eustace the hedgehog next day en casserole. Mark the sequel. At 2:30, prompt, Eustace, the teetotaler, turned Nile green, started groaning like a lost soul, and continued to do so for the remainder of the week, when he was pronounced out of danger. Freddy, on the other hand, his system having been healthily pickled in alcohol, throve on the dish and finished it up cold the next day. I call that the most disgusting story I've ever heard. The most moral story you've ever heard. If I had my way, it would be carved up in letters of gold over the door of every school and college in the kingdom as a warning to the young. Well, what have you been doing with yourself all the morning, my dear? I expected you earlier. I was talking to my precious Ronnie most of the time. He went off to catch his train about 30 minutes ago. Oh, yes, he's going to young George Fish's wedding, isn't he? I could tell you a good story about George Fish's father, the bishop. If it's like the one about old Freddy Potts, I don't want to hear it. Well, after that, I went to look for Lord Emsworth because I had promised Ronnie to talk pig to him. But I saw Lady Constance with him, so I kept away. And then I came to see you and found you talking together. You seemed to be having a very earnest conversation about something. The Honourable Galahad chuckled. Clarence has got the wind up, poor chap, about that pig of his. He thinks Parslow's trying to put it on the spot or kidnap it. Sue looked round cautiously. You know who stole it that first time, don't you, Galley? Baxter, wasn't it? The thing was found in his caravan. It was Ronnie. What? This was news to the Honourable Galahad. That young fish? She gave his hair a tug. You're not to call him that young fish. I apologize. But what on earth did he do it for? He was going to find it and bring it back, so as to make Lord Emsworth grateful, you see? You don't mean that young clothhead had the intelligence to think up a scheme like that, said the Honourable Galahad, amazed. And I won't have you calling my darling Ronnie a clothhead, either. He's very clever. As a matter of fact, though, he says he got the idea from you. From me? He says you told him you once stole a pig. That's right, said the Honourable Galahad. Puffy Benger and I stole old Wivenhoe's pig the night of the bachelor's ball at Hammers Easton in the year 95. We put it in Plug Basham's bedroom. I never heard what happened when Plug met it. No doubt they found some formula. Wivenhoe, I remember, was rather annoyed about the affair. He was a good deal like Clarence in that respect. Worshipped his pig. What makes Lord Emsworth think that Sir Gregory is going to hurt the Empress? Apparently, Connie has gone and engaged his nephew as Clarence's secretary, and he thinks it's a plot. So do I. But personally, as I told Clarence, I feel that Parslow is using young Monty Bodkin purely as a cat's paw. Monty Bodkin? The nephew. Now, I'm convinced, from what I remember of him, that he isn't at all the sort of fellow... Oh, Galley, cried Sue. Eh? Monty Bodkin coming here? Sue stared in dismay. Oh, Galley, what a mess. Oh, I knew something was going to happen. I told Ronnie so. I've been feeling it for days. My dear child, what's the matter with you? What's wrong with young Bodkin coming here? I used to be engaged to him, said Sue. It seemed to the Honourable Galahad that advancing years and the comparative abstinence of his later life must have dulled his once keen quickness at the uptake.
Sue's face had lost its colour, and anxiety and alarm were clouding her pretty eyes, and he could make nothing of it.
"Were you?" he said. "When was that?"
2 years ago, 2½, 3, I can't remember, before I met Ronnie.
But what does that matter? I tell you, I used to be engaged to him."
The Honourable Galahad was still fogged.
"But what's your trouble? What's all the agitation about? Why does it upset you so much, the idea of meeting him again? Painful associations, do you mean? Embarrassing? Don't want to awake agonizing memories in the fellow's bosom?" "Of course not. It isn't that. It's Ronnie."
"Why Ronnie?"
"He's so jealous. You know how jealous he is."
The Honourable Galahad began to understand.
"He can't help it, poor darling. It's just the way he is. He makes himself miserable about nothing. So what will he do when Monty arrives? I know Monty so well. He won't mean any harm, but he'll come bounding in, all hearty and bubbling, and start talking of old times. Do you remember? I say, Sue, old girl, I wonder if you've forgotten. It'll drive poor Ronnie crazy."
The Honourable Galahad nodded.
"I see what you mean. That touch of old lang syne is disturbing. Why, he tries to pretend he isn't, but Ronnie's jealous even of Pilbeam."
Once more, the Honourable Galahad nodded, a grave nod. He quite realized that a man who could be jealous of the proprietor of the Argus Inquiry Agency was not a man likely to be introduced to former fiancés, especially of the type of Monty Bodkin.
"We must give this matter a little earnest consideration," he said thoughtfully. "You wouldn't consider taking a firm line and telling Ronnie to go and boil his head and not make a young fool of himself if he starts kicking up a fuss?"
"But you don't understand," wailed Sue. "He won't kick up a fuss. Ronnie isn't like that. He'll just get very stiff and cold and polite and suffer in a sort of awful Eton and Cambridge silence. And nothing I do will make him any better."
An idea struck the Honourable Galahad.
"You're sure you really are in love with this young fish?"
"I wish you wouldn't. I'm sorry I forgot, but you are."
"Of course I am. There's nobody in the world for me but Ronnie. I've told you that before. I suppose what you're wondering is how I came to be engaged to Monty. Looking back, I can't think myself. He's a dear, of course, and when you're about 17, you're so flattered at finding that anyone wants to marry you that it seems wrong to refuse him. But it never amounted to anything. It only lasted a couple of weeks anyhow. But Ronnie will imagine it was one of the world's great romances. He'll brood on it and worry himself ill, wondering whether I'm still not pining for Monty. He's just like a kid in that way. It'll spoil everything."
"And we may take it as pretty certain that Monty will let it out?"
"Of course he will. He's a babbler."
"Yes, that's how I remember him. One of those fellows you can count on to say the wrong thing. Reminds me rather of a man I used to know in the old days called Bagshot. Boko Bagshot, we called him. Took a girl to supper once at the garden. Supper scarcely concluded when angry old gentleman plunges into the room and starts shaking his fist in Boko's face. Boko rises with chivalrous gesture. 'Have no fear, sir. I am a man of honour. I will marry your daughter.' 'Daughter,' says old gentleman, foaming a little at the mouth. 'Damn it, that's my wife.' Took all Boko's tact to pass it off, I believe."
He pondered, staring thoughtfully through his black-rimmed monocle at a spider which was doing its trapeze act from an overhanging bough.
"Well, it's quite simple, of course."
"Simple?
Presents no difficulties of any sort, now that one gives it one's full attention. Ronnie won't be back from that wedding till late tomorrow evening. You must run up to London first thing in the morning and warn young Monty how the land lies. Tell him that when he arrives here, he must meet you as a stranger. Pitch it strong. Explain about Ronnie's unfortunate failing. Drive it well into his head that your whole happiness depends on him pretending he's never met you before, and I should think you'll have no trouble whatsoever. I shouldn't call Monty Bodkin particularly bright, but he ought to be able to handle a thing like that if you make it perfectly clear to him what he's got to do."
She drew a deep breath.
"You're wonderful, Galley, darling."
"Experienced," corrected the Honourable Galahad modestly.
"But can I do it? I mean, the trains."
"On your head. 8:50 from Market Blandings gets you to London about noon. Interview Monty between then and 2:30. Catch the 2:45 back, and you get to Market Blandings somewhere around 6:45. Take the station taxi, stop it halfway up the drive, get out and walk the rest, and you'll be in your room with an hour to dress for dinner, and not a soul knowing a thing about it. No, even better than that, because I remember Connie telling me there's a dinner party on tomorrow night, so I suppose you won't have to show up till nearly 9.
But lunch? Won't they wonder where I am if I'm not at lunch?
Connie's lunching out. You don't suppose Clarence will notice whether you're there or not? No, the only point we haven't covered is, can you find Monty? Do you know his address? He's sure to be at the Drones. Then all is well. Why on earth you worry about these things when you know you've got an expert like me behind you, I can't imagine. It's a pity about young Ronnie, though, that disposition of his to make heavy weather. Silly to be jealous. He ought to realize by this time that you love him. Goodness knows why.
I know why.
I don't. Fellow's a perfect ass.
He's not.
My dear child, said the Honourable Galahad firmly, if a man who doesn't know that he can trust you isn't a perfect ass, what sort of ass is he?